This is Professor Richard Hand from the University of South Wales congratulating you on your excellent taste for choosing this station and podcast.
Marvellous. So, John, in terms of science fiction in the main, that's just a quick straw poll here. Gabriella, if I say the word science fiction, do you feel as though you want to run to the Rock of Gibraltar? Or what are your feelings on this whole thing?
I think I watched Star Wars for the first time last year.
And that was the symbol, the symbolic striking of the microphone there.
I
like
zone
a Buddhist
out
temple.
Yeah.
Striking sound, actually. Sorry. That
was wonderful. You know, well done, Holly.
I think I watched Star Trek as well last year. I'm not too sure.
Good heavens. Well, it's important to differentiate, because obviously Star Trek, boldly going where...
We had a lesson on Star Trek during university.
Good.
It was great, a lecture about Star Trek.
Well,
was great.
This is nice, exactly. Yes. Who delivered that one, then? Was that
Barney.
Gary?
Barney, yes. It was about leadership. So we watched Star Trek and then talked about Captain Kirk's leadership.
Now, he was obviously going for Kirk as opposed to Jean-Luc Picard. Is that right?
Let's
dig a little bit deeper here. Yes, yeah. let's drill down in terms of Kirk, portrayed by William Shatner as opposed to Chris Pine.
Chris Pine.
We're talking Star Trek the movie then.
Yes.
Yes, as opposed to the TV series.
Yeah, that one, the film.
the film, exactly. And were we Star Trek, as in the original, or Star Trek Into Darkness? This is a critical question for Phil Leonis later on.
He skipped through half the film. He just showed the leadership parts.
Just showed the leadership parts.
Well, just showed when Chris Pine was taking control, and that was about it.
Right. So when Kirk takes control. There are a couple of texts which are well worth accessing called All I Needed to Know for Life I Learned from Star Trek.
Yeah.
And All I Needed to Know About More Life I Learned from Star Trek The Next Generation. So that was good routine there. Isn't it? Nice. Okay. So I think we might identify it's not, don't worry, it's not Star Wars there. Not saying anything wrong with Star Wars, but we got Star.
So Holly.
There we are. By the way, have you watched the opening to Living Daylights as yet?
Not yet. I'm horrible.
Holly, science fiction, what does it suggest to yourself?
I haven't read science fiction. I'm more of a crime.
Crime,
like gory.
Gory,
reader. Like weird crime thrillers.
Weird crime. I think we're
maybe.
Which
authors?
I can't remember because it's a while since I've read it. But I think that's the books I kind of read.
Yeah.
But then when I was doing my dissertation, I don't know if it was a book. I can't remember what film it was that I studied. But that was really interesting, and I studied like The Other, which could be applied for science fiction. So.
Yeah.
That was quite good.
The whole alien side of things comes very much in terms of the other and a line of things from that perspective. So there we have it, John. Probably not atypical in terms of structures and so on. Nobody's actually mentioned the names Raines, Pringle, Kennedy, Neville, or indeed Park, but they will, I'm sure, in a matter of course. You know, maybe a few other name checks in terms of lines from that thing. We've talked about this at length, of course, and we'll continue to do so, really. Science fiction getting out of its ghetto, or is it a case of we're still balancing that whole thing through in terms of what we call science fiction and so on?
Well, in book terms, basically 1 in 10 paperbacks bought in the UK is science fiction or fantasy. So that's a lovely market. The success of George R.R. Martin, to go on to the fantasy side, Game of Thrones on television has woken a lot of people up to the fact that all fantasy isn't about hobbits. And it's interesting that the guys here talk about the films, because it is in some ways a very different thing than the literature of science fiction. I mean, a lot of people will say science fiction Star Trek or science fiction Star Wars.
Doctor Who. We've got a controversial thing about Doctor Who coming up in the next part.
And fantasy, Lord of the Rings. But it's a lot broader than that. It's a big market, but not everybody's going to like it any more than everybody likes crime or historical fiction or biography or anything else. So it's not about preaching, it's about try it. If you don't like it, you don't like it. But SF can do anything. It can be a thriller, it can be a mystery, it can be an historical novel.
Yeah, Blade Runner. And indeed, is James Bond science fiction? Interesting.
No.
Well, but Moonraker, you know, it's still, yes. I'm currently just reworking my way through the series of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. I think Spyfy is a whole range of things. Let's give a few name checks too. Richard Webb, Jasper Kent, Philip Palmer, Ian Sayles, Adam Neville, Lee Kennedy, John George, Rory Pringle, Harvey Raines, and Mark Newton. There we are, you see. I think you should actually just reduce your fee on the basis of the promo.
Some of my clients.
Increase your fee. It's all there. It's working through. And we'll talk about what being a literary agent and a script doctor actually entails. I mean, we've heard about script doctoring. What do you think a script doctor entails, Gabriella?
Writing the scripts or editing them? I don't really
maybe
know.
Maybe just
editing?
Making them come back to life after they've kind of been, the ghost has been given up. And you think, what do you think, Holly? Script doctor?
Picking them apart, seeing what, seeing if, well, a doctor's someone who cures something, so.
Curing the script?
Curing the script, improving.
Yeah. Like you cure a Harry.
Well, exactly. But now it's time to press that MM button. Holly, and what does the MM button actually bring us?
The Michelle Monroe.
Tonight I'm introducing a much-recorded popular song. Originally, it was a 1945 French song, La Feuille Morte. Translated literally, it reads The Dead Leaves, with music by Hungarian-French composer Jovi Kosma and lyrics by poet Jacques Prévert. And the Hungarian title is Hello, Levelek. American songwriter Johnny Mercer wrote English lyrics in 1947, and Joe Stafford was among the first to perform this version. It became a pop standard and a jazz standard in both languages, both as an instrumental and with a singer. On December the 24th, 1950, French singer Edith Piaf sang both French and English versions of this song on the radio programme The Big Show, hosted by Tallulah Bankhead. The 1956 film, starring Joan Crawford, featured the song as sung by Nat King Cole over the title sequence, while Frank Sinatra, Andy Williams, Al Hurt and Manfred Mann followed suit. George Martin led Stad's Olympic recording studio session in February 1968, with all the selected tracks targeted for his new album, The Late Late Show. It was one of Dad's favourites. It is Autumn Leaves.
The by the window, the autumn leaves
Now, I appreciate there are folk who probably would turn around and say, what are you playing a song about autumn leaves in January for? Well, it's still a good tune. I think, Gabriella, what did you make of Matt Monro and Autumn Leaves?
Yes, it was very nice. A soothing song, I guess.
Okay, that sounds like Holly.
Yeah, I agree. Nice instrumental part. Good.
And John.
Grew up with Matt Monro, one of my favourite voices.
Oh, there we are. Says it all in so many ways. So coming up next, we will be going over to Los Angeles to speak to the Los Angeles Master Chorale Chief Executive Officer. That'd be the fabulous Terry Knowles. It's the 50th anniversary, of course, of the Los Angeles Master Chorale. And, of course, they'll be talking about the Bach B minor mass and so on. To take us round to that, we're just going to get another little flavour of one of our little favourites as far as the Los Angeles Master Chorale is actually concerned. It is, of course, the interpretation incarnation of Hold On. Richly deserved round of applause, as we said, as it's 2 minutes past six here on Siren 107.3, as far as the UK time is actually concerned, and that means, of course, in Los Angeles, I think it's just coming up to 2 minutes past 10 a.m. or 10:02. Holly, what did we make of the Los Angeles Master Chorale and Hold On?
I love that.
It is a wonderful.
It's so good.
It is a genuinely wonderful
Every
thing.
Time I hear it, you're like captivated.
Every time we hear it, we're simply captivated. Gabriella?
Are you singing along yet? Are you singing along yet?
I was going,
I think we're getting there. Yes, the voice you just heard, Chief Executive Officer for the Los Angeles Master Chorale, the fabulous Terry Knowles. Welcome back, Terry. How are we?
Thank you. I'm just wonderful, and I'm so happy to talk with you all again. Happy New Year.
And yes, absolutely.
Happy New Year.
Work through that. Gabriella, hold on from yourself.
Thumbs up. I enjoyed it. Yeah, it was great.
And John, is that the first time you've encountered the Los Angeles Master Chorale?
It is, and it was fabulous.
There we are. And it's going to get even better, because on January the 25th and the 26th, if we fancy hiring the Learjet to actually fly over to the joys of Los Angeles, it's the Bach B minor Mass that you're focusing on, isn't it, Terry?
That is exactly right. There's a performance on Saturday afternoon at 2 and Sunday evening, and guess what? There's not a ticket to be had.
I'm not surprised. I mean, you know, this VIC, so tragically, we were all set up as well for our first visit to Los Angeles, but it's okay. It's sold out. John, you said this was a particular favourite of yours.
Yeah, I was actually listening to the entire Mass last night. I'm, you know, wonderfully emotional. My old friend Nancy, who sang in choirs for many years, said I must mention the Agnus Dei, which is just amazing. And it's an hour 50. It's a long piece, isn't it?
It is a long piece. There's about just exactly 2 hours of music. Yeah. We will take a break along the way, but it is a glorious, monumental masterwork.
Yeah.
And it happened. We're doing it this weekend, which is our 50th anniversary weekend. The whole season is the 50th, but we're going to focus especially this weekend. And the Master Chorale's very first independent concert on January 27th of 1965 was the B minor Mass. And so there is a wonderful sort of symmetry about that that we like very much, and we're very excited to do these performances.
Don't think you could choose a better piece.
Well, there we are, or indeed a better chorale to actually perform for the whole thing. Now, earlier again, well, back actually, earlier in 2013, which is the year, of course, we emerged from, I know Phil Learness was keen to actually see the festive celebrations that Los Angeles Master Chorale was actually doing. He, I think, was amazed and truly impressed by the whole system. Looking back now, Terry, another series of triumphs for the Los Angeles Master Chorale, presumably.
That's very nice of you to say, and I do actually think about it that way. We are still talking about opening night, which seems so long ago now, September 22, but it was a glorious launch to this 50th anniversary season. So much music spanning 5 decades of 4 different music directors' vision for this ensemble. It was really something, and we're just very excited about it. So it's been a great, great first half of the year, and there's lots left.
Exactly. We've only just started in terms of the season for that. John, questions from yourself.
But really, what are your favourite composers? Who are your favourite composers? What are your favourite pieces of music, Terry? Or is it too difficult to say?
Oh, my goodness. That's something hard.
I know.
You know, I have to say that I am partial to Morten Lauridsen, who was the composer in residence of the Master Chorale for between 1995 and 2001, who has written so much glorious music, as you know. Mm-hmm. One motet called Omanium Mysterium was actually commissioned by my husband for me as a Christmas gift in 1994. And so I really would have to say that's where my heart lies when it is all said and done.
Very understandable.
It makes perfect sense in all ways. The production on the 25th and 26th, is it at the UCLA Royce Hall that the thing's taking place? Or rather, on the Sunday 26th, is it at the UCLA Royce Hall? And on the 25th, is it at Glendale?
The Los Angeles Chamber.
Yeah, quite right, exactly. It's been a fun evening. It's been a really fun evening here. You know, earlier in the production, I put it down to presenter incompetence. You know, now we quite look at Stuart Francis, supposed to Stu Francis.
We have very good friends and colleagues at LACO, and we're sorry that we are in direct conflict with one another, but our performances are at Walt Disney Concert Hall.
Exactly.
On Saturday night, we have the 50th anniversary season gala, just to make sure there's enough to do in the weekend. This enormous gala will take place actually in the building where I am right now, the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, the original home of the Los Angeles Master Chorale. So there will be some 400 gussied-up guests and a lot of partying going on. So it's a full weekend for us.
Sounds ideal. And I say one of these days we will have to make our way over there. Gabriella, questions or thoughts from yourself?
You're thinking,
oh, you kind of got me off guard there.
Oh, well,
yeah, sorry.
The thing that always struck
me. I was thinking about the party that you were having.
Oh,
I was like, that sounds so good.
About party.
A weekend of party, that sounds great.
Let's face it, when you and Sebastian Bach was putting the whole thing together, you thought, what's the party going to be like?
Exactly.
The tunes just go into the whole thing. Inspirational, I think, is one of the adjectives that always springs to mind when people listen to the work of the LA Master Chorale. And is that something which, again, you feel generates from not only your own enthusiasm but also the membership of the chorale?
It is inspirational in a variety of ways, and one of those, I think, is that the music that Grant programs and then these virtuoso performances inspire our audiences to want more, actually. It's interesting to me, I don't know why it didn't dawn on me before a couple of days ago, that after the Bach concerts, the remaining concerts of this season, of which there are three, all feature music of living composers. Everybody, at least as I'm speaking to you, is still alive and well, whose music we will perform in March, a concert of Morton Lord's, and in early April, a concert, I guess I just lied to you, Paratan is actually not with us anymore, but David Lang and Steve Reich are, and then at the closing concert, we do several pieces of new music with several composers in the room, and it's really not entirely conscious gesture to look forward to 51 and the next 50 years, and we're just very excited about what's yet to come.
And indeed, looking at lamc.org, the Los Angeles Master Chorale website at the Walt Disney Concert Hall, the Bach B minor Mass, as we've said, 2 p.m. on Saturday, January the 25th. Lord, it's one of those days. Well, that's the third mistake. So. Do you know, I'm sure there'll be presenters of breakfast shows on Saturday. I'll say, I'll play that back regularly. Oh, I'll make sure he knows about that. Saturday, January the 25th, 2014, and indeed Sunday, January 26th at 7 p.m. Some of the statistics here are quite interesting. 115 singers, symphonic orchestra, and indeed you've also got a pre-concert talk, which is always, I think, fascinating, Terry, in terms of getting the views of Grant Gershon and indeed the host, Alan Chapman.
Grant and Ellen have been doing this for several years, and the room in which they do it is always packed to the rafters because it's so insightful and so helpful to our audience as they anticipate hearing the music. Grant is also doing something a little bit, I think, unusual with the Bach this weekend. He, rather than a quartet of soloists, which you would expect, there are 12 soloists. So the 12 people will sing the various arias and so forth that would typically be sung by a quartet of just four. So it's an opportunity to feature a dozen really magnificent soloists who are also members of the LA Master Chorale.
Indeed, as you rightly say, Johann Sebastian Bach, Mass in B minor. It was the big bang that started it all. Not one single choral work goes further back with the LA Master Chorale than the B minor Mass. The Dorothy Chandler Pavilion was only 123 days old when music director Roger Wagner, suitable surname, I think, Roger Wagner, very good, stepped onto the stage to conduct Bach's beloved masterpiece as the first ever performance by the Los Angeles Master Chorale. Grant Gershon temporarily sets aside his penchant for intimate, historically informed performances to present a Bach concert designed to blow the roof off Disney Hall, featuring a much larger chorus and orchestra for this grand anniversary occasion. I'm sensing, John, we really should sort of coordinate this and get over to Los Angeles.
I need to be in LA.
Yeah.
But there are no tickets.
Oh, I know.
You know what? You just come on over and we'll figure that out. And the weather is gorgeous. Hey. So come
Terry,
on
you're
over
a sweetheart.
This is brilliant stuff. And in fact, I'm going to ask Holly to throw those last two questions to you before we head off to Alan Stevens. And then back with Los Angeles, of course, with Kelly Duncan Joyner and then Phil Leonis. Holly, to you.
Terry, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
I always enjoy talking with you and I hope I will have another chance.
Good. And that's really, and you've already answered my next question.
Terry knows. She were actually, next time we will get some musical samples of the Los Angeles Master Chorale. I think
I'd love Hold On, but some
we
more.
Need to, yeah, we'll get a few
Let's
more.
Branch away, but
yes.
Keep playing.
Keep that. We'll
nice.
Work our way through that. So hopefully, say CDs and DVDs are in the production stages, Terry.
Yes, absolutely. There's music from our opening night concert that you can download from our website, and there are many more plans for such projects in the near and not so near future. So very exciting time.
And as we said, the website, usual 3 W's, lamc.org.
fortune's down.
Man behind CaldorCity.com, Magic Bullet Productions, and Aisha and Zukov. Now at last has his own station ident. It'll take just a teeny bit longer for Fiona Moore.
So Penny Evans has just noted on Facebook, "Hi Alex and Holly, I'm here now." It's all right. It's
hello, Penny.
Hello, Penny. Yes, good to have our Buxton correspondent in full force there. And, of course, last week she was joining us and tuned into a whole range of other things. She'd catch up with some of the other programme on the podcast. We've already featured Cameron Tilbury, Anna Lewis, of course, Stu Francis, Michelle Monroe, and Terry Knowles, of course, Chief Executive Officer for the Los Angeles Master Chorale. But last week, obviously, it was just thee and me, Holly.
It was.
That's it. Very nice, very effective.
And I just like to say I hope Penny's performance went well. She was performing at... can't remember, but she was talking to
Penny,
me about it on Facebook.
Well, so there we are. We hope your performance went well. I'm sure it did. But we did feature Alan Stevens there, and Alan obviously went into Doctor Who, as we would expect, a Doctor Who scholar.
Oh, yeah. That conversation is
to the extent, I think full-on conversation is very
appropriate. I think I got a slap on the wrist for not being a Doctor Who.
Well, yeah. To the extent that Phil Leonis obviously took this on board.
Yes, he did.
And, you know, said his own. So I then get any... It's wonderful about communications, John, because, as you know, you put the thing out there, people debate, and they work through all sorts of things. It's what we do. You know, we open that up here on Siren 107.3 FM, and quite rightly so. Alan said... I'd like to have a right of reply to something Phil Leonis actually said. So that's why he's back again now for a few short moments to actually sort of work through that. So, Alan, has that set the scene effectively? Is that you know, the rationale for why you are sandwiched between our Los Angeles Master Chorale, so, and Kelly Duncan Joyner, also from LA, and obviously the upcoming Phil Leonis?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if I've only got a short few minutes.
Yes.
Then,
yes.
Shut up.
No. No, share with
us.
Give me
a chance.
Okay. The floor is yours, Alan Stevens. What was the issue you had with Phil's comments about your own work? This could go on forever, obviously, but we'll have an editorial.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I think I've looked up Phil Leonis on IMDb, and he has an impressive credits of various programs he's done and various films he's produced. I think he's a very impressive guy. You know, my hat off to him.
Yes.
And his cat also has a very impressive name.
Yes. Fuzz Aldrin.
Fuzz Aldrin, as I was about to say, Fuzz Aldrin, yes. you know, I've got no problem with Phil at all. It was just that when you spoke to me last week, you said, in fact, I've listened to it again, actually. It says, how should you start watching Doctor Who if you've never actually seen Doctor Who before? Mm. And my reply was that you have to watch it either from 1963 or 1970 or 2005, and if you don't do that, then you're wasting your time. You'll be complete completely incomprehensible to you. But of course, you know, that reply was ridiculous, because any television show which requires you to have, you know, at least watched it for 7 years before you can understand it, or going back to 63, 50 years to understand it, wouldn't have got 15.2 million viewers for its 60th anniversary story. It probably got 9 because it would have been so convoluted and so impenetrable that people would have, you know, the audience wouldn't have been there. I mean, I have not seen all the Doctor Who episodes because all the Doctor Who episodes do not exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite sure that a lot of people who watch the show have not watched all, I can't tell you how many episodes, 700 and something episodes there have been in the programme. I mean, that would be...
Okay, that seems okay. Let's turn to our science fiction guru and indeed literary agent, John Jarrold. Is that a fair comment from what Alan's been saying there, as far as the Doctor Who question is actually concerned?
Yeah, sadly, I'm old enough to remember watching the first episode in November 1963. But I think it's also true of novel series. Series work better than one-offs. And people blend into the series and the characters, and it's the characters that make it work. And if the characters and the actors are good enough, then you will get into the background gradually, but it's the story and the characters that draw you in first.
Yeah, that's exactly true. I mean, Phil says is...
Phil has actually sent in a little line here, actually, even before his system. His line, I've been enjoying another top-notch edition of the Midweek Drive, Alex Levchuk's programme on Siren FM. If you miss a little, you miss a lot. But not to worry, you can always catch up with the podcasts at southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com or our website.
How utterly relevant that was.
I thought it was worth sort of noting that. Phil would appreciate
it. Well done, Alex. Yeah, yes,
okay.
I agree, yeah.
Carry on.
Going back to the subject... what Phil said was listening to what I was putting over was like plunging into a sort of Hunger Games of academic competition, which I think is a wonderful phrase and wonderful use, and exactly what I was trying to kind of convey in a... but then he says that there's such legacy and such breadth of material that it is so imposing that he finds it a little bit terrifying. Well, to be honest, once I moved the cat out of the way... sorry, Zuko's trampling all over me.
This is Zhukov as opposed to Aisha. Very important, good.
the thing is that if you ask me a question concerning Doctor Who, I will not consider it, I will not take it seriously. I will give you the stupidest possible answer I can give you, because basically the people listening to this show, even if they've watched Doctor Who, won't even remember the last episode they've seen. It's only like hardcore people like you or me who actually remember the story or even any details of the plot. So, you know, I kind of think that a ludicrous answer is 100 times more interesting than a straight and truthful direct answer. Having said that, I didn't know that Phil was actually listening in and expecting a rational answer.
Not only that.
If I had done, then I would have said, to be honest, the way Doctor Who is produced, that you can watch any episode at any time, and the details of what you need to know will be conveyed in that episode. And any knowledge of, you know, which companion William Hartnell had, or who the Brigadier was, is completely irrelevant. You know, even when the Daleks appear, and they've appeared 50 years ago, the fact is that, you know, within the episode it will convey that these are bad guys and that their plan is bad, and the Doctor needs to try and defeat them, because if they won, then we'd be all exterminated or something. And that's as far as the show goes. I mean, you know, we're not. You do not need to know a mass of geeky or nerdish, trivia going back to 1963. That seriously, Phil. Listen, I was joking. You know, I was playing up. I was playing a part to be entertaining and funny. You know, it isn't true. It's like Star Trek. I mean, you know, there's some great episodes of Star Trek, but you can enjoy, you know, an episode like
A Taste of Armageddon. Or
without
Shore
having
Leave.
Without having watched Forbidden Planet, which was the origin of it, or
Red the Tempest,
or any of the episodes before, or any episodes afterwards, you can just watch. In fact, do an experiment. I mean, you could actually take a Doctor Who episode. If we had a two-part of a new series or a four-part of the old series, and you come in episode three, details of what had happened before will be stated by the characters, so anyone who has not watched the previous episode will be able to pick up that thread. And the fact is that when I was a kid, I missed episode two. I went to go to a wedding and I missed episode two of a story called, I can't even remember what it's called. They had the Rutan, Horrifying Rock. And yet, episode three, you know, at the age of 12, I was still able to pick up what had happened in episode two, but the fact that some characters were no longer appearing every day.
I should hope so. It was the Rutans versus the Zontarans, or at least not the Zontarans, but the Rutans were there.
It was the Rutans who,
Okay,
so
enough information.
You know, it's like any other TV show, period.
There we are. I think we've what do you think? Do you think we've resolved the situation, Gabriella?
Yeah, I think we've quite understood what's happened.
Yeah, it could open up a whole new
channel. I didn't listen, unfortunately, to Midweek Drive last week.
It's okay.
But I get what's happening. Yeah, I got what's happening through the conversation.
Precisely. You see, that's it. You know, you can obviously go back to 2010 in terms of archive shows, and we like to put that in for the aficionados, but you can also drop in on the show and hopefully get a little something
exactly.
Of that. Holly, you'd like to promote something that's happening in February that one of your former tutors actually said you must promote this. So quick message.
The Lincoln Company is presenting The History Boys at the LPAC, the Lincoln Performing Arts Centre, on Thursday the 13th of February at 7:30. Your tickets are around £10, £8, £5. A superb life-enhancing play, says The Guardian, with a insight post-show discussion included.
It's fantastic. And Penny Evans has just said, I love Doctor Who as much as my passion for The X-Files. I even wrote a crossover fiction for both shows, which is steeped in quantum theory.
Well, that's fair. I mean, the thing is, if you're writing for a panel, I remember years ago I wrote a Blake Seven story, which I produced on audio, and Baronet's heard it, and didn't understand a word of it at all. Mm. And then he produced two orders, which the fans hated. Mm. And the reason why they hated it was because he didn't understand the show, and basically he's not a very good writer. His episodes were prosaic.
He's passed on. He hasn't got writer reply now, you know.
I don't, good job.
Oh, yeah, right.
He had writer reply, and he took that writer reply on the DVD of The Curse of the Paladon. So he's hitting a far wider audience than I am.
I don't know.
What I'm saying is, you know, I don't think his stories are very good, and he didn't understand the show. But the fact is, there is a difference between a Blake 7 episode written for a TV audience, which will tune in and watch it and forget it, and then watch the next episode, and not necessarily even seen the previous episode, but will be able to pick up the thread. And something that was aimed directly and specifically at a fan audience that know the shoe size of Aeron and what.
And on that bombshell, to quote a well-known Radio North Norfolk digital scenario, we will say there'll be more of this when we talk about Parsec, which is a new series which Dave Milling, myself, will be presenting in the not-too-distant future. Alan, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic chat with us today?
Yes.
Are you coming back again in the not-too-distant future?
No.
You see, they don't all say yes, you know. But you could have been it could be irony. We just
I've
don't know.
I've got a question for you, actually.
Yes, yes.
I've been commissioned to write a review of a Star Trek, and so Sion as well, of two Star Trek episodes from the original series.
Yes.
Although we've managed to track down Wolf and the Fold of Fiona, we haven't managed to track down on the internet a copy of What Little Girls Are Made Of from me. You don't happen to have a copy of that, do you?
We do. What Are Little Girls Made Of? Starring, of course, our erstwhile presenter Sherry Jackson as the android. One of the androids, of course. Yeah. Anyway, life continues. Ted Cassidy's in there as well. He was Lurch in the Addams Family.
What a way to talk
over the Carpenters and Superstar. I don't know. We'll carry on. Kelly Duncan join us up next from Los Angeles. Then Phil Linus. Can we all say bye-bye, Alan?
Bye, Alan.
Cheers. Bye-bye, Alan.
Bye. Just the radio. Come back to me again and play your sad guitar. Don't you remember you told me you loved me, baby? You said you'd be coming back this way again.
Ah, so much to do, so little time. Superstar, and of course Karen and Richard Carpenter, leading to the superstar of the agency field, who's also the mother of a young superstar, and he's doing all sorts of superstar kind of things. It's Kelly Duncan Joyner. How are you, Kelly?
How are you, Alex? So great to be speaking with you after so long.
I know, this is true. And you, of course, were the first of our Los Angeles contactees way back, I think, in 2007, 2008, with Shirley Jones, Academy Award winner, and all sorts of things. But, yeah, nope, we never forget the quality that comes through. So share with us, Kelly, what is life like now you're running your own agency, given that we've got a top literary agent in the studio? That, of course, would be the legend John Gerald. And, John, you've been over to LA a few times, have you not?
Yep, been there for conventions, conferences, and meetings.
Conventions, conferences, and meetings. Oh, my.
my is right.
Exactly. So how's life, Kelly, in this... Oh, well, I mean, is there ever a hiatus now? I mean, we used to always look at the notion of, there'd be pilot seasons, then you had mid-season replacements, then you had a whole range of other factors, then you got the commercial things. Does it ever stop, Kelly?
It does not stop. It does not stop, and I would like to, because agents... And I'm not the only one. Anyone who chooses to do what I do, you never get a vacation. Perhaps there. Actually, I take that wrong. Between Christmas, December 25th, and New Year's is probably the only time that I don't have to be constantly hooked up to my computer and the phone. But other than that, I am constantly attached. Boo hoo, Kelly. Yeah. So I never get to have a rest. But here I go on my third cup of coffee for the day.
Well, this is important. We like to feel that we're helping you through. It's what, you know, Siren FM and Midweek Drive, we do for the Los Angeles early morning folks. You know, I mean, Phil usually sort of wakes up with us on that basis. And if you want the really early version, of course, there's Midnight in Los Angeles. We start off with a Midweek Drive morning edition tomorrow. Gabriella, you'll be with us for that, I presume.
Yes, I will.
Exactly. Our first Lincoln Agricultural Society show special with the Lincoln show for 2014. Yes, I get the right year. John, does what Kelly has just been saying there, does it resonate with yourself as a literary agent? Is, I mean, because I know, and you said, well, when am I needed for this show? I said, well, we'd like you for the whole show, ideally.
Yeah. Well, yeah, basically exactly the same about the Christmas New Year thing, because UK publishing closes on Christmas Eve and reopens on the 2nd of January. So those are the days when you're dead right. I don't have to be at my desk all the time. I still have the iPad and the mobile on, because if something happens and an author just wants a quick chat, then we can do that. But yeah, those are the days. I mean, I get away for 3-4 days now and then, but again, the iPad and the mobile are always on, so if anything urgent happens, I can deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But there again, you know, we run our own businesses. We don't have to report to some corporate idiot.
Steady. Yeah, obviously no names on that particular basis there, but dear Lord, you know, the level of Mensadom in...
Oh, I can name a few.
Well, you and me both, Kelly.
It all works so superbly. We're also in what I'm defining very much as the annual award season. Richard Fitzwilliams, who's our regular film critic here, will be joining us again tomorrow morning, and hopefully we'll be taking part in the Lincoln Inspired Festival as a sort of film panel that we're looking to develop with Sarah Bullimore and others. We've had, obviously, the Golden Globes, we've had the Screen Actors Guild and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, have you had any clients that are sort of up for these material in terms of that you'd like to share with us? So, I mean, obviously...
Oh, the type of actors that I have are the supporting cast. I wish I could say that I have some I've represented Oscar winners in my life, but they were past Oscar people or actors, but no current nominees. It would more fall in line in the Emmy nominations. I represent more TV actors and people that help support the leads.
And as you know, Kelly, we're always delighted to celebrate the joy of the supporting thespians and so on, and more than happy to share that across the airwaves to build their CV and get that whole campaign going. John, similar questions to yourself. I mean, obviously not for the Academy Awards and so on, but in terms of the literary season and so on, presumably, I mean, just share with us your career, potted history, because it really is, it's a, Kelly, this is a movie just waiting to be helped, to be developed.
No, not so, hardly.
No,
I worked in publishing science fiction and fantasy between 1988 and 2002.
Wow.
I ran Orbit. I ran the SF list at Random House and then the SF list at Simon & Schuster. And then I got fed up with the corporate side. So since 2004, I've been a specialist agent, only science fiction, fantasy and horror. And as I said, it's so much more fun to get up in the morning, go into my office in my house and work without somebody breathing down my neck and saying, can you come in for a meeting about a meeting?
Right. No, I know. And especially for me, having worked a little bit on the literary, which I have bowed out, that is such a difficult realm to get anyone to try to read something.
Yeah.
It's, with mine, I send a picture and they can watch something visual,
for
you know,
sure.
a video, a reel of something. Maybe they'll watch 10 seconds if I'm lucky.
Yep.
But having to have somebody even read 3 lines...
I know.
A log line is crazy.
I mean, it's
to get
true that...
someone to do that. But I had to throw my hat in. I'm like, I'm done. I can't. It takes so long. It takes so long to get anybody to read something in this town.
It's true that every editor in London...
I take my
10
hat
pages.
Off to you.
No, not at all.
Yeah. Yeah, so
in terms of 10 pages, is that the number of pages they read? And
90% of submissions, any agent, any editor, are turned down in the first 10 pages because it just ain't special enough.
Yeah, it has to grab you.
It does.
Yeah,
you have to say, wow,
within the first second.
In those opening
yeah.
pages. Luckily, I deal with a lot of editors who have known me for 25 years, so they trust me to some degree, and they're willing mm-hmm. to take what I do seriously. But even so, you know, if it's not 100% wow, then it's 100% no.
And it's terrible because my husband is a writer, and he'll hand me a script and it'll take me 10 days
yeah.
before I even read my own husband's script. I'm like,
Can he not make an appointment? For goodness sakes. It's just a line of that.
And he's got 5 seconds to tell me about it. Yeah. So
it is quite a challenging pitch because, you know, Holly, you must have been faced with this in terms of the business of show and so on. And we have something special and unique in the East Midlands Radio Station of the Year here. And so far as, you know, our managing editor, Andrew David, we open up a whole range of things for that. You know, when you're faced with that, does it make you lose heart? Do you think, I'm still going to battle on through there?
Yeah, I think I take that approach with anything, though, from the cheerleading side of things.
Coming up very soon, some Holly Cox original music. Not on this show, but in future
coming
weeks.
Up, yeah. I think, even with that, I mean, the first time me and my band recorded something, I was like, oh, this sounds horrible. Yeah. I was like, is that really what we sound like? And then years passed, and then now it's kind of got better, and that's the same approach with like the cheerleading squad. It was awful when we first started. We had like 6 or 7 of us competed at 14. Now there's about 40, 50 of us in the squad. You've just got to give it some time. Whereas this, though, is completely different. You've got no time because you've got so many things coming in and people just want answers. So, no, I do appreciate what you're doing, though.
The best author I ever worked with, Ian Banks, took 13 years from his first submission to a publisher to his first book deal. So don't get worried about it. Get on with it. If you're going to be a writer, be a writer. If you're going to be an actor, be an actor.
And that, of course, is the late, great Ian Banks,
yep.
Who hopefully you're looking down and seeing all sorts of magical things there. Gabriella, does this resonate with yourself? I mean, obviously, you've got all this fun to look at, really, as you graduate and so on.
Yes. Slightly, I guess. Not too sure.
Believe. That's the important
thing.
Believe.
I should believe in myself more.
Oh, yeah. And I think, as you rightly said, John, if you want to be a writer, write. If you want, you've got to do it. You've got to practice
getting
those skills.
Getting published is the jam on the bread. It's not the bread. If you're a writer, you write.
Yeah,
that's exactly. Almost a
no, mic. I completely agree with that. You've just got to keep going.
Exactly. So on those lines, Gabriella, would you like to throw those last two questions to Kelly Duncan Joyner, please?
Hi, Kelly. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
As always.
And will you be joining us again?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah.
You see,
in the nearer future.
Positivity, none of this kind of deep irony that we get from our Gloucestershire correspondents. I mean, wonderful stuff there. Kelly Duncan-Joyner, as ever, a delight. Coming up next, slightly later, but he's still on board, as we just take another little link from Penny, who's actually sort of said she's happy to share her audiobook with us. It's wonderful. It's great.
Oh,
it's great.
Nice.
Anyway,
thank you.
It's a strange town.
Racing commentator and voiceover artiste, proudly presenting the Midweek Drive's regular 6:30 p.m. correspondent. Whether he's in his PJs or not, the truth is out there, director extraordinaire, Mr. Phil Leonis!
Okay, so, all right, 6:40 as opposed to 6:30. It's just been a packed programme in so many delightful ways, honestly. So, moving on, as Penny's also said to Holly, I didn't know you were in a band, Holly. Would love to hear your stuff sometime. Yeah, you will,
booster
on the show.
Booster seats. Type in three of us don't need booster seats showcase
performance. Well, that's an interesting intro.
And we performed at the LPAC in 2009.
Lincoln Performing Arts Centre. Let's be corporate. Let's move it the proper name. We're sorting our
Lincoln Performing Arts Centre.
Exactly.
It.
Phil Leonis, welcome to the show. Have you enjoyed what you've heard so far? Because, John, this is the moment where we get those classic director's notes. Important.
I start with two questions. First a question, and then actually a request for something that I did not hear on the show but would like to, because I stepped away during that part. But my first question for you, Alex, is if Penny Evans were in studio as a co-presenter, would you then be forced to read her Facebook posts to other shows?
Probably.
Because what would you do during all that time that you usually spend? I don't know. But hey, you referenced an impression that you did. I heard the interview with Stu, and that was awesome. But you referenced an impression that you had done earlier in the show, and I missed it, and I was wondering if I could get a reprise.
I could crush a grape. End of. There we are. Thank you. It's gone very quiet now. Do you think that's destroyed?
Maybe do another one.
No, I'm... There are only so many grapes you can crush, love.
Like,
you know,
we could all do like.
We could all crush a grape. We could all crush a grape. Exactly. There we are. Here was I trying to actually sort of set things right with Alan Stevens acting as the diplomatic go-between there, write a reply, and you know, cats across the pond and so on. Who do you wish to speak to first?
Like acting as the go-between trying to settle something. He didn't have a problem with me. He actually felt bad that I had not gotten the information that I wanted and just wanted to help me out, which I appreciated a great deal. So I don't think there was really much of a problem. But you know what it did bring to mind? And this whole discussion, of course, science fiction, I have so many notes down here. But another question that I would ask him, and I would imagine he would be the person to ask, or perhaps yourself, but, you know, when I was growing up, it was a time between when Star Trek, the original series, had gone off the air, and before Star Trek, the Motionless Picture came out. And so those of us who were fans, we really enjoyed all the novelizations, all the novels, the original fiction that were that was being published on a monthly basis, and is there not a literary tradition of Doctor Who as well?
Yes, there is, and Alex will tell you about it.
Well, the New Adventures line, which obviously was led by Virgin and then taken over by BBC and a whole heap of other fine folk, probably kept the fires of Who burning in the wilderness years between the series' original cancellation in 1989, through the Paul McGann movie in 1996, through, of course, to the reincarnation under Russell T. Davis in 2005. In fact, Russell T. Davis actually wrote one of the New Adventures series. So, yeah, it certainly did work on that basis. So lots to get into, as opposed to Gabriella to using the Chris Pine incarnation of Captain Kirk to demonstrate leadership. But fast-forwarding through the thing to actually find leadership in that, I think is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I enjoyed that lesson. It was probably one of my most enjoyable ones.
There we are. Barney Chowdhury.
Getting to watch a film.
We salute you. Wherever you happen to be. Anyway, great stuff on that basis. So, Phil, carry on. The floor is yours, because I don't want to sort of interject too often in terms of, other than, of course, to read Penny Evans' sort of lines out, which we can work through that. So it's marvellous.
Well, I am always amused when ever a song like Autumn Leaves is played, and the more young among us describe the song as soothing, whereas those of us approaching those autumn leaves start to find the song haunting. It's quite a shift in temporal perspective, to stick with the sci-fi theme. I also am amused when people say that they're not really science fiction fans, you know, that they don't really, you know, they don't watch science fiction movies, or they don't read science fiction novels, because, of course, it overlooks this fact that science fiction is a very wide tent. It is a very large umbrella. And so from romantic films and books like Never Let Me Go to animated films like WALL-E, to Oscar-nominated Best Picture nominees this year, not only Gravity, but also Her.
Yeah.
Or comic book movies like The Avengers, or, you know, and on and on and on. This is a genre that can truly tackle any question about what it means to be human in any genre. And so I always, when I dig deeper with people, I usually find that on their list of their favorite movies and television shows or books or et cetera, there are quite a few entries of science fiction, but they've never thought of them as science fiction before.
Yep.
Lots of yeses there, John. I take it
you agree. Agree. It is, you know, throughout life. And as you say, it's about what it is to be human, what it is to be alive in any form. Some humans, some not. I was reading Marvel Comics at the same time I started reading science fiction, around 1967. So I grew up with both of those things.
And how do you feel about Avengers versus X-Men, the current incarnation, the restart for Marvel, where Scott Summers has seemed to be, he's gone ballistic in his own sort of way.
I always preferred the Avengers anyway.
And there we are. I was very confused. As a matter of fact, this is an interesting British-American setup, because when the Avengers comic was released under Power Comics, which of course was Wham and Terrific and Fantastic and so on, I thought, oh, got the Avengers and Terrific. No sign of John Steed, Bowler Hat or Emma Peel whatsoever. It's devastating. You might need to Google those, Gabriella, because otherwise...
Yes, probably.
You know,
Emma Peel was the first TV character I fell in lust with.
Yeah, I see. I was more Atlanta Shaw in Stingray until I realised that there's no future for me in a 6-inch puppet. But never mind.
Given what they managed to accomplish with the big screen version of the Avengers, I think it might be okay if we just stick to the Marvel Avengers for a little while.
you're saying Ray Fiennes and Uma Thurman didn't quite capture the moment, and Sean Connery. Hello.
Look, they're all gifted performers. I mean, I would never place blame on the feet of an actor for when something like that goes so far awry. But it certainly seems from the conception stage, like so many of these, that the people who decided, oh, this would be a good thing to make, had no affection for the original show. And you know, sometimes when movies are adapted from source material or television series are turned into movies, sometimes they work quite well by bringing in fresh talent. Like when Nicholas Meyer came on to revitalize Star Trek with Star Trek II, he had not been a Star Trek fan, so he came as an outsider. But he was a person of great integrity, so he went back to the original series and said, look, many people love this. I should try to find out what they love while not feeling enslaved to that fandom because I am outside them. So he really said, look, there is to me no such thing as really ultimately science fiction versus any other kind of narrative.
Yeah.
Is it worthy storytelling?
Absolutely.
Or is it not? And if it's worthy, then let's pay honor to that. And I don't know what led me off on that, but other than the fact that the Avengers with Ray Fiennes did not seem to honor anything.
But as I said earlier, it's about the story and the characters. If you don't care about those two things, it doesn't matter a damn what the special effects are like.
Absolutely. And, you know, Alex, you mentioned that some of the world of James Bond could be considered science fiction. In fact,
one person in the studio vigorously disagreed with me, it has to be said, but never mind.
Well, I would say that every James Bond film after From Russia with Love until For Your Eyes Only exists in the world of science fiction, in that the story cannot exist without speculative science underpinning it. In another sense, as kind of a jocular aside, James Bond became little more than a robot. So, it is films up until, I think the Timothy Dalton movies, they tried to restore a sense of humanity to it, and then obviously with Daniel Craig. But I think it really did exist mostly within the world of science fiction for a couple of decades.
Would you like Penny Evans' view on this, Phil? I mean, I was sort of seeking the permission to actually read one of her posts here.
Well, I fear her response to this, and yet where there is fear, there is always desire. So please, by all means, go ahead.
I prefer science fiction and supernatural to other genres. The stranger and weirder and intelligent, the better. And science fiction authors do tend to be ahead of their time, and the stuff they create in their minds sometimes becomes reality as years progress. There you are, John.
Yeah, I mean, what you don't try and do is predict the future, because that's what nonfiction does. So you say, what if? So, you know, if this happened, how would people react to it? Because it's about people, not about an event per se.
Holly, you were sharing with us in a sort of very quiet thing. It was Forbidden Planet. That was the movie I was trying to actually sort of catch over that point.
Yeah, Forbidden Planet.
Yeah, because that's what you did your dissertation on, of course.
Yeah, I looked at three films relating to The Tempest, obviously Caliban, and that was one of them. Very odd film. I had to watch it. Yeah, I don't know. I was watching it kind of in a very quiet part of the library, and it was like a very bad edition of it that I'd found. But yeah, I mean, the stories were great. I think because I've
Monsters of the Id.
Yeah.
Monsters of the Id.
Yeah, and it was very kind of reading into it confusing for me at some parts. But I think because I'd watched it after I'd watched all kind of new science fiction movies, I was just thinking, oh god,
what is this?
This is just they're like the backdrops, and it was just everything was
first use of the miniskirt, of course, in popular culture. The designer Anne Francis was wearing,
but it did remind me of kind of like Robbie the Robot with kind of the old style, like Daleks, and like how they made the robots into like now it's kind of computer generated, and it is really effective.
this idea of adapting Shakespeare into science fiction is, it seems to me, a wonderful wedding. I mean, Shakespeare was reaching back into, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away and telling his stories. And, in fact, when Sir Patrick Stewart first took on Star Trek, you know, interviewers would ask him why he was slumming, why he went slumming into the world of
Dune, of course. I mean, he was actually the teacher in Dune for Kyle MacLachlan's Paul Atreides.
Absolutely, and that went so well that who can blame him for repeating it. But really, there was this kind of looking down the nose at it, and he was very quick to defend the genre and defend especially Star Trek and what Next Generation was trying to do. By pointing out all the similarities with the Shakespearean work that he'd done, not the least of which is they both offer a language of their own that at first blush might be off-putting to some people until you recognize that, again, the humanity and the emotion is right on the surface.
Yep.
You don't have to translate it. You just have to engage with the characters.
I realise, Gabriella, a lot of this might have left you thinking, as, you know, quite rightly so, when I saw studio discussion topics, the student-agent paradigm, the SF phenomenon, and the comedy-drama balance, but I wasn't expecting the Spanish Inquisition. No, weren't you kidding? For a Gibraltarian, that's not a good line to use.
No one expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Exactly. No, it's awful.
She speaks as one who knows in past lives. But have you got, I mean, does it resonate what we've been saying today in terms of where we sit with respect to science fiction and how, as John Blunt saying, actually, it's the characters, it's the story,
yes,
it's the narrative.
It did quite interest me when you said, because I always say I'm not really that into science fiction, but when you did point out films like WALL-E and all the rest of them, I did realise maybe I do watch it, probably.
Are there funnier modern movies than Real Genius with Val Kilmer or Ghostbusters?
Yeah.
I love Ghostbusters.
These are science fiction films, you know? And there is a documentary hosted by William Shatner, mm-hmm. produced by William Shatner, called William Shatner Changed the World. And really what it is, and it's a wonderful award-winning documentary, and really what it is about how Star Trek changed everything because of the generations of people who were inspired by these writers who asked, what if?
Yep.
And then said, well, wait a minute. If someone can imagine it, then someone can achieve it. And so it really charts all the ways that we take, advances that we take for granted in our daily life and how those directly were inspired by people who said, I see that on Star Trek, I want to make that happen in real life. So it's an extraordinary documentary.
It's time for the return of Mike Dooley.
You know how the wind, no matter how blustery, remains as silent as it is invisible until it meets with leaves and kites and flags and such? Well, it's exactly the same with the manifesting forces that make dreams come true until they meet with expectation. And right this second, they're whirling all around you, my little chiquita. Happy everything. The universe.
Splendid. Just in case you thought we weren't actually using some of Mike's own versions of the notes from the universe.
Alex, why did you follow my speech with a quote of a blustery wind?
Forces.
Yeah, it's the vortex that's actually there. John, have you enjoyed your first full 2 hours unexpurgated 7,200 seconds worth of the midweek drive?
It's been fabulous.
So you can be back again sometime.
Oh, yes.
Splendid. And, of course, don't forget, Lincoln Inspired John is one of our patrons, so fantastic stuff there. And your website, John, is?
johnjarrell.co.uk.
johnjarrell.co.uk. Holly, have you enjoyed the programme?
Yes, thank you.
Gabriella?
Yeah, of course.
Back again tomorrow morning?
Yes, definitely. Maybe for 45 minutes. Going to have to leave for class, but I'll be here.
Exactly. And Holly, of course, you'll be joining us here with Gabriella for our little the station celebration of the presentation of East Midlands Radio Station of the Year, which is wonderful. We all take joy in that. Last two questions for Phil Leonis, please. Holly?
Phil, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
It has been fascinating.
And I'm sure we'll hear from you again next week.
In keeping with the quantum temporal discussions, future versions of myself have already returned.
There we have it. You know, coming up, the news from the Sky News Centre. And, of course, we've got Groundworks at 9 o'clock, plus a whole heap of other goodies on Siren 107.3 FM. To Gabriella Peralta, to Holly Cox, and to John Gerald, thank you for joining us. Also, Cameron Tilbury, Anna Lewis, Stu Francis, Michelle Monroe, Terry Knowles, Kelly Duncan Joyner, and Phil Learness. Thank you, and thank you, dear listener. Can we all say bye-bye?
Bye.
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 Bye.